Asking in a queer space about pronouns doesn't stop me from being removed from women's toilets, doesn't stop the weird looks and crawling humiliation. The only thing that really stops that feeling has to be myself, has to be writing it down, has to be finding others like me and being able to speak it out loud.
Our dual butch identity is somehow unacceptable. For many, the idea of two butch women being together is confusing, and two butch mothers is more confusing still.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. India's High Court privacy ruling signals sodomy law repeal, Finland retains infertility rule for legal gender change, and why butch is not a dirty word. All that and more this week, because you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 26, 2017. The August 24th decision in a privacy rights case at India's Supreme Court could signal the demise of the country's notorious anti-queer penal code, Section 377, a holdover from British colonial rule that outlaws carnal intercourse against the order of nature. The case challenged mandatory use of national biometric identity cards. They're required to receive government services or to even open a bank account or to get a phone line. Privacy advocates challenged the mandatory cards because they collect a slew of personal information and data. India's Attorney General argued that the right to privacy must be forsaken in the interest of welfare entitlements. But the 9-judge bench ruled that the right to individual privacy is an intrinsic and fundamental right under the country's constitution. The justices took potshots in their 547-page privacy decision at a previous 3-judge panel high court ruling upholding Section 377. This week's edict called sexual orientation an essential attribute of privacy. The rights of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender population cannot be construed to be so-called rights, the High Court said, attacking a conclusion in the earlier decision. Their rights are not so-called, but are real rights, founded on sound constitutional doctrine. Foes of Section 377 have unsuccessfully lobbied the government for many years to repeal the law. In a separate case, a larger High Court bench is specifically reviewing that earlier 3-judge panel ruling that upheld it. In light of the strong connection the justices made this week between privacy rights and the fundamental right to queer identity, LGBTQ activists are hoping that the larger High Court bench will finally strike down Section 377 as unconstitutional.
But in a setback for transgender rights, Finland's government announced on August 25th that it had decided to maintain the requirement that trans people be sterilized before they're allowed to change their legal gender. The decision thumbs its nose at a recommendation of the United Nations Human Rights Council that Finland join its Nordic neighbors Denmark and Sweden in dropping the requirement. The European Court of Human Rights also ruled in a case in April that requiring sterilization for gender recognition is a human rights violation. The Finnish government gave no reason for rejecting the proposed change, stating only that the abolition of the infertility requirement is not included in the current government's legislative plan.
A White House memo has outlined some of the details of President Trump's ban on transgender people serving in the U.S. military. It instructs the Pentagon to refuse to admit new transgender recruits, to stop paying for the trans-related health care of currently serving members, and to not renew their enlistment contracts. The memo gives the Pentagon 6 months to implement the ban, which Trump infamously announced on Twitter in late July, reversing course on the Obama administration's plan to fully integrate transgender enlistees into the U.S. Armed Forces. The National Center for Lesbian Rights and GLBTQ legal advocates and defenders have already filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the ban. Advocacy groups Lambda Legal and OutServe SLDN announced this week that they'll be filing their own lawsuit. Los Angeles Blade reporter Karen Oakham reports that religious right ideologue and Vice President Mike Pence has been the moving force behind the bigotry. In fact, she wrote, he has been spearheading the trans ban reinstatement since last May, at the behest of conservative leaders such as Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council and scores of retired anti-LGBT military officers. Trump's fear of his evangelical base, Occam concludes, is more powerful than his promises to the LGBT community. Thousands of transgender people are currently serving honorably in the U.S. Armed Forces.
Meanwhile, Lambda Legal has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Departments of Justice and Education, seeking documents related to the withdrawal earlier this year of Obama-era guidelines on how schools should treat their transgender students. A press release charged that the departments pulled the rug out from under transgender students, leaving them even more vulnerable to harassment and abuse. We need to know why. The non-binding guidelines issued in 2016 under President Obama recommended that schools use trans students' preferred names and pronouns and allow them access to restrooms, locker rooms, and other sex-segregated facilities that match their gender identity. It also provided guidance on dress codes, privacy issues, and protection from bullying and harassment. The guidelines were withdrawn in February, a month after Donald Trump was sworn in as the nation's 45th president. Under a Freedom of Information Act filing in March, Lambda requested correspondence with any groups outside the government, communications with the president's staff, and instructions to staff about how to handle inquiries and complaints about discrimination, bullying, and harassment based on gender identity or transgender status. But neither Attorney General Jeff Sessions' Justice Department nor Secretary Betsy DeVos's Education Department has complied. Lambda filed its suit on August 22nd in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York.
In other news, fears that a marriage equality postal plebiscite in Australia would give license to hateful anti-queer campaign rhetoric have been realized. Resisting a free vote in Parliament, which would almost certainly open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples down under, the coalition government of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is pushing a voluntary, non-binding postal vote as the only way to resolve the issue. Stop the Fags posters, citing scurrilous information about homosexuality, such as equating gay people with pedophiles and labeling same-gender attraction a curse of death, have sprung up in and around Melbourne. Flyers calling lesbian and gay people the tragedy of a family have appeared in Sydney. Leaflets in English and Chinese, distributed among the large Asian community in the Sydney suburb of Hurstville, warned that voting for marriage equality would open the door to counterfeit women rapists in public restrooms. The Australian Traditional Nationalist Group, which claims to advocate the protection of white identity and the traditional Western values rooted in Christian and pagan traditions, is behind posters in Brisbane targeting families headed by same-gender couples. Mothers and fathers' love is irreplaceable, they read. Traditional marriage must be protected. Opposition Labour Party leader Bill Shorten has been among the many critics of Turnbull's push for the postal plebiscite. We know this bile will end up in the playground, in the schoolyard, and on the sporting field, Shorten said. The slogans will be shouted at the children of same-sex couples. Young people who are gay will be confronted by it on social media every day.
The postal plebiscite is set to begin in mid-September and run through early November. However, some LGBTQ activists are challenging the validity of the $122 million proposal in Australia's High Court. Their case is scheduled to be heard in early September, so the way forward isn't at all clear until a ruling comes down. There were encouraging signs for equality activists this week if the vote does go forward. The Australian Electoral Commission released information about what it called an extraordinary surge in the number of people registering to vote in the postal plebiscite ahead of the August 24th deadline. Since the marriage equality vote was announced in early August, almost a million Australians had either enrolled for the first time, mostly young people, or updated their voter registration status. And a poll conducted by the Rupert Murdoch-owned Australian newspaper, less than a month away from the proposed postal plebiscite, showed almost 2 in 3 voters are planning to say yes to marriage equality.
And finally, Ugandan queer activists and their supporters ended a challenging week with a secret pride celebration in Kampala. For the second year in a row, the government shut down a planned LGBTQ Pride Festival by threatening violent police intervention. Organizers of this year's scheduled events reluctantly announced the cancellation through a statement in the Kuchu Times, citing serious concerns for the safety of participants. All Out and Rainbow Riots, two of Pride Uganda's international partners, spearheaded what All Out executive director Matt Beard called a gathering that was full of joy and defiance. To ensure safety, the location was kept secret, and drivers took all the invited Pride celebrants to the venue. Writing on his Facebook page that, "We danced the night away," Petter Wallenberg, founder of Rainbow Riots, said that, "We couldn't let this week finish without reaching some kind of triumphant conclusion." Local activists vow to push for more visibility. Isaac Mugisha, chair of the Pride Uganda Organizing Committee, told the Washington Blade that there is no way people will accept that there are LGBT people in Uganda if we don't stand out.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 26, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
Have you checked our website lately? For now playing information and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, log on to thiswayout.org.
To every young man who can't pass, from every lipstick, lazy lass, from every drag queen's high-heeled stagger, dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, do the bull dagger swagger, yeah.
The art of understanding and talking about gender identity issues has deepened over the last generation. From feminism's reevaluation of the role of women in the 1960s through the LGBT liberation movement and the development of queer theory, the many nuances of gender expression are becoming clearer. Giselle Hanna of 3CR Community Radio Melbourne's Accent of Women program chats with two contributors to a new Australian magazine dedicated to one swaggering aspect of the gender discussion.
Butch is not a dirty word is a brainchild of butch activist Esther Godoy. This publication is about reclaiming female masculinity and the identity butch. What started as a photography project grew into a place for queer voices to express their thoughts and experiences about butch identity. Madeline Imber is one of the co-editors and Tandiwe Abimoyo is a contributing writer. Let's just start with, what is butch?
My name's Madeline. I think it really, like, the point of the publication, and I guess my perspective, is it's a self-identification. So, you know, anyone can identify as butch. The thing that drew me to the zine was my personal experience of being read as masculine of centre as a woman. So part of it was being read as a lesbian and any kind of issues or positive aspects that came from that, but also being read as male. The reason that I responded to Esther's call out was that I worked a lot in schools. I worked in a lot of different schools and I would travel around the state going into classrooms and I would often get a little bit of heckling from some of the kids because I look masculine of centre and they couldn't work out if I was male or female, or they thought I was a lesbian or they assumed I was a lesbian, and kind of I got a little bit of abuse for that. And they're kids, it's fine. It was manageable in that context. But, you know, every now and then I'd get home and be quite frustrated by it and frustrated by the state of our education system, but also frustrated that this was an experience I was having and I didn't have a community around me that reflected it. And so when I saw the call out, it wasn't about getting my face in the zine or, you know, necessarily writing something for it. It was about finding a community because I'd spent enough time whinging that I didn't have one. I thought I was just going to have to go and seek it out. So for me, it's about my experience as someone who doesn't look conforming in terms of my female gender, and I don't conform to what society feels like I should look like. And so that's my perspective on why I guess at various points in time I have and do identify as butch.
Hi, I'm Tundi. I think I would probably echo a lot of that in terms of it's about self-identification. I think for me, I spent quite a number of years living in the States, and I think that's probably when I came into my own kind of identity as a butch. It was kind of handed to me. I think other people there just kind of read me and assumed I identified as butch, and then it started to kind of fit and feel good and reflect how I kind of felt comfortable moving in the world and wanted other people to kind of read me. When I moved back to Australia, I found that there wasn't really much of a community around butch identified or masculine women. So when I saw the zine come together with the first issue, it was pretty exciting.
I want to talk about butch inside the queer and the broader LGBTI community. And I think there have been a lot of advances in the LGBTI movement. You know, same-sex marriage has a lot of traction and is reaching quite broad public acceptance. But with that comes a greater space for other issues, particularly I'm talking about gender identity and a conversation around non-binary gender and transgender and so on. And do you, I wonder what you think and what you have to say about butch versus trans. And I even get the complexity of that construction as well. But do you feel like butch gets collapsed with trans at all? And then what's your response to that?
You know, speaking personally, I don't want to speak for the zine, especially around issues that are so complex, but I think what the positivity of the first and the second edition has been very much based around inclusivity. So the idea that the trans movement, you're right, has gained a lot of traction in the last few years, and the trans community is really coming into its own and come into a really strong political space, which is fantastic. And I think that the zine is about being part of the broader queer space and around the identity of butch not being seen as a dirty word and being seen as another identity within the queer community, obviously different to trans, but also something that in some ways troubles or messes with gender. And I think the more that we can trouble gender and talk about that and open up a space, the healthier it is. It's not about a dichotomy of, well, you're either butch or trans or those two things are in opposition. It's very much about there's room for all of them. What pronouns do you prefer? This is a new question. I often confuse people with my gender presentation, but twice now I've been asked what pronouns I prefer and it makes me uncomfortable. It shouldn't, because they're well-intentioned. It's a way to acknowledge everyone's experiences and sense of self. And I've often felt my sense of self is lacking, so I should appreciate this effort. I hear women talk of the power of their high heels, the power of that favourite dress, and how when they're getting all dressed up, they feel sexy, powerful, invincible. I feel that way in a finely cut pair of pants, a crisp shirt and boots. And I can't work out what it is about a fresh, sharp haircut that makes me feel like $1 million, but it does. And then I leave the house. Despite being used to it, it doesn't take much. A double take from a smirking teenager, a confused look from a middle-aged woman, perplexed, then disgusted. And then my swagger shrinks and the shame sets in. I suddenly feel the shame of the world seeing me as a young boy, then more shame when they realise I'm butch. My clothes can be my armour, but also my undoing. I never know how I'm going to be read, but I can recognise the revulsion a mile away. And from strangers I can sometimes bear it. The twist of the knife is when it comes from women who like it, as long as no one else can see me with them. I think most of the time they don't even know. They can't articulate the shame they feel for desiring someone who looks like me, and how that desire marks them as deviant too. At these times, I feel an intense amount of shame, shame that being asked about my preferred pronoun should counteract, but for some reason it doesn't. Asking in a queer space about pronouns doesn't stop me from being removed from women's toilets, doesn't stop the weird looks and crawling humiliation. The only thing that really stops that feeling has to be myself, has to be writing it down, has to be finding others like me and being able to speak it out loud, has to be knowing there's nothing to be ashamed of.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the taboos. Just what we're talking about, the complexities of gender identity and the label or the identity of butch. Because I think a lot of people would also assume that butch was femme attracted, for example, and that there is a whole world of assumptions associated with butch, like it is inherently masculine and therefore male replicating. And I wanted, Tandi, I wanted to put that to you a little bit, particularly about this idea that butch and femme go together and there's no other way around that.
Well, my partner's also butch identified, so as a kind of butch-butch couple, we have kind of confronted that quite a bit. I think particularly in the States where there is this much stronger, I think, butch femme community, it's really challenging, I think, for a lot of people in that community when there are two butch women together. I think some of the reactions that we experienced over the years reminded me, I guess, of kind of the sort of revulsion and panic that straight men sometimes exhibit towards gay men, that other butch women would kind of find the idea of two butchers together as kind of repulsive and wrong and, you know, dysfunctional, as those kinds of homophobic attitudes. And that was really hard to deal with, especially from, you know, your friends who you kind of think you actually share a lot in common with.
And you're also a parent.
Yeah.
So I wonder how public perceptions of you as a butch parent and a butch-butch couple parenting children. I mean, I don't know how many more complexities I can throw into the mix.
Sure.
But.
Look, I think there is an assumption that, you know, parents and, you know, mothers are feminine and that they, that is where the nurturing side of, you know, being a mother comes from. And so I think if you sort of embrace your more masculine attributes, that that's kind of seen as being the antithesis of being a good and nurturing mother. I've been a stay-at-home mum for the last 6-7 years. And I think that certainly within the predominantly kind of straight world of mums and young kids, it's hard for people to read me as being a masculine woman. I think it's easy for them to read my partner as a butch woman because the analogy of, you know, her being kind of like their husbands or, you know, the fathers who go to work and wear a suit and tie and, you know, do stuff on the weekends with their kids is easy to understand. But I think it's been hard to kind of feel that I've been able to maintain my identity as a kind of masculine centre woman. When Nick and I got together and I started introducing her to my friends, people were confused. A few months into our relationship, I moved to the US while Nick stayed in London. I told my American friends about her and was beyond excited when she visited. I hadn't described her in great detail. It hadn't occurred to me that I should. I wasn't prepared for the reaction I got when Nick arrived and they realised that my partner was not femme, but another masculine-identified woman. The inherent naturalness of the butch-femme dichotomy is particularly strong among queers of colour, and the strongest sense of confusion, horror and rejection came from this community. One femme friend in particular clearly felt a very personal sense of betrayal. Her identity was so firmly rooted in her femme self that me choosing a butch partner and breaking those unwritten rules ultimately strained our friendship to a point from which it never fully recovered. Some years later, when Nick and I moved back to my hometown of Melbourne, we were getting ready to have children and therefore had less involvement in the queer community. We both knew we wanted kids, it was just a question of who and how. Although, of course, nothing is ever that simple in the world of lesbian fertility, I like to say that in the end, I drew the short straw and scored the role of carrying our two children. Pregnancy itself wasn't easy. I didn't relish the changes to my body and my wardrobe the way I know many women do. But I figured it was only 9 months and then things would get back to normal, right? I assumed, perhaps naively, that once our child was born, the small detail of who had given birth would fade into insignificance, that I would be free to embrace my more masculine attributes once again, and that the sense of social equality that Nick and I had enjoyed previously would resume. However, as a stay-at-home mum for 6 years and counting, I find myself in a world that clearly expects that role to come bundled with femininity, and so is no longer able to read me as a masculine woman. Meanwhile, as the non-biological or birth mother, Nick is expected to fulfil some kind of father role, and her visible butchness only serves to reinforce this. In this way, we often find ourselves being divided into rigid gender roles in ways we didn't before becoming parents. It is easy to feel that my butchness is erased while Nick's is enhanced, based on the biological and logistical choices we've made in forming our family. While I stay at home with our kids, we're both parents. Nick isn't the one throwing a football while I cook. Our roles are divided by time and skill, not by perception of gender. From looking for maternity wear, the options for masculine women were scarce and non-existent, to how many straight friends perceive us, butchers and gender has played into our family. At barbecues, women are making the salads while men take charge of cooking the meat, and we're expected to make a decision of sorts as to where we stand, quite literally. But who gave birth? By who knew which person better? In a well-meaning way, it felt like there was an assumption that because Nick is butch and wears a suit and tie to work, I must be femme. A loss of identity through having kids was unexpected. I expected to lose time, sleep, and independence, but I didn't think my sense of self would also be deeply challenged. In a return of what happened when we first got together, our dual butch identity is somehow unacceptable. For many, the idea of two butch women being together is confusing, and two butch mothers is more confusing still, and therefore one must be recast as femme or closer to it. The other day, however, in a shopping centre bathroom, I turned in the direction of a once familiar sound, a sharp intake of air, to find a horrified, confused woman staring back at me. After taking it all in, she spluttered out, "I know it must be awful for her," looking apologetically at my daughter, "but you really should take her into the gents." So despite a few challenges along the way, some days I successfully pull it off. A butch and a mum still receiving helpful guidance on which bathroom to use.
That was Madeline Imber and Tandiwai Abby Moyo. Make sure you look up butchisnotadirtyword.com and check out their Facebook page. Accent of Women is produced in the Melbourne studios of Community Radio 3CR with the financial assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you want to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can write to us at accentofwomen@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or like our page on Facebook. I'm Giselle Hanna.
I went to the ladies' room, I had to pee. Why was everybody staring at me? A little girl giggled, a lady gasped. One woman almost had a heart attack. She started doing the bulldagger swagger. Do the bulldagger swagger. Do the bulldagger swagger, yeah.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Giselle Hanna and from John Dyer V and Michelle Yeader, produced by Steve Pride. Frank performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WESU Middletown, Connecticut, CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.